Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Shala. That was really great and sent me off on all sorts of directions. This is, if I'm allowed, a comment rather than a question, though perhaps others would like to formulate questions. I'm a Methodist minister, and I was very taken by your reference to the fact that hymnody formulated British Protestant identity more. But I'd just like to say a bit about Methodist history very quickly.
I didn't make statements.
John Wesley was very much part of the international movement in Europe, and that's very much forgotten by Methodist historians. One of the first things he did after his heartwarming experience in May 1738 was to go to Herrenhut, to where Zinzendorf and the Moravians had their headquarters, because he'd been so influenced by them. Secondly, and lastly, if he had not died before Wesley, Wesley's designated successor was Jean de la Flechère, a Swiss pastor who would have been his successor. So just to throw in a bit of Methodist influence into this. Thank you very much.
No, thank you. And all that, I think that's a really important thing to note. And I've kind of restrained myself, and I apologise to those who are not Church of England. I've very much restrained myself here, or restricted myself to a kind of state church narrative, an established church narrative, so Church of England and Church of Scotland. And you're quite right, and we could look at international Baptist movements, and actually Baptist, what is the relationship between Baptists and Anabaptists in the 16th century? That's also a really interesting question. The Pietist movement, the sense of great awakening and evangelicalism across, and one of the things I find really intriguing is that evangelicalism in the 18th and 19th centuries is a deeply international movement, and the Evangelical Alliance is founded very, very early. Mission societies are often profoundly international. So the London Missionary Society is sending out German missionaries because the Basel Mission hasn't been invented yet. So there's all sorts of things we could do. So thank you very much indeed for that, and reminding us this is not just a question of 16th and 17th century. It's not just a question of established churches. There are all sorts of international religious movements we should be looking at. So thank you.
As the last speaker didn't ask a question, perhaps I could ask two. Firstly, a rather silly point, but if, as a historian, amongst many other things, would you like to comment on why so many leading Brexiteer politicians read history at Oxford at a certain stage in their careers? And the second point is perhaps a bit more serious and comes out of the Theos think tank, a.k.a. the thinking deep part of the Bible Society, which just published a paper on perhaps one of the roles of the church in such volatile and disunited times is to hold, start, contain, develop, whatever verb you would like to use, issues around identity and culture.
I mean, that's a very interesting observation about Brexiteers and reading history of Oxford. I should have to go and read their biographies and see where they fit in. But that would suggest, I do think that English historiography has a profound problem, and that actually Christopher Haig, whose work I very much value, I want to make that very clear, I think it's excellent work, but it's a real example of how a really good historian can fail to look beyond the boundaries of our island, and actually some even look above the border. So I can't answer that question, but I think it's really interesting. I didn't read history myself. I read maths, as you referred, and then theology. So perhaps I'm coming at this from a rather different perspective. What is the role of the church in all of this? I think that is a crucial question that actually the Church of Scotland has been better at grappling with than the Church of England has. And that's not to say that I think the Church of England should have done what the Church of Scotland did. I think the Church of Scotland as I say, it's a chicken and egg situation. I think the Church of Scotland could partly take the very clear role that it took in the Brexit referendum, because it was clear that in Scotland things were less divided than in England. Having said that, it's also the case that Presbyterians, churchgoers in Scotland, as far as I can see from the statistics, and they are really difficult to get at for Scotland because we don't have the kind of YouGov polls, but it may be that Church of Scotland members were less tended to vote Remain. That's a question. I do think what we have to try to do is to provide a space for people to pull out the issues. If you like, I think we need the kind of conversations that we had around sexuality. We ought to be having them about political questions. And if we can't do that in the churches, what does that say about how we're thinking about the relationship between church and society? And one of my concerns, this is getting us into a much bigger discussion, but one of my concerns is, I worked in the Citizens Advice Bureau in London in the mid-1980s, and one of my most inspirational texts was Faith in the City. Where is our faith in the city today? We're facing social disintegration in so many parts of our countries. And what are we saying about it as a church? And that really concerns me, that we seem to... Is it that the church is now so marginal since the early 80s, in the last 30 years? Have we lost so much confidence? Have we lost so many people that we feel we can't speak into those situations? What is it? Or is it that our theology has changed, that we think it's less important to speak into those situations? What is it that has happened to churches that means that somehow we think the only good church is a church that's not talking about social and political issues? I'm not saying we all have to agree. We're never all going to agree. But why can't we at least talk about it? So my theology was formed by liberation theology in South Africa in the 1980s, so I'm going to be always wanting to be saying the church should be out there preaching the gospel, because actually the gospel is deeply political, in my understanding.
Anthony, do you want to ask a question?
Take the liberty to start with it. Sorry.
No, sorry, you're far away.
Can I take the liberty to start with an observation, then my question, which is rather different? That it has been said by that eminent philosopher, Al Murray, the pub landlord, that the trouble with the European Union is that it was named wrongly. Mm-hmm. That had they called it the British Empire, we would have had no trouble. So perhaps that's why the historians...
The German Empire, the French Empire. Yes, yes.
And didn't Al Murray read history at Oxford?
The question which I asked you in the break, and you asked to discuss, is that the English Reformation, I was taught when I did my theology, which was a bit before you, was that Cranmer was not influenced actually so much by the main reformers, Luther and Calvin, as what I referred to as the minority reformers, Bucer and Zwingli. And therefore, there was no obvious alliance between the English Reformation and the major continental powers, which were either Lutheran or Calvinist. Did that make a difference?
I can leave it alone, can't I? Because you're controlling it. I just need not to give you my English Reformation lecture, because we'll be here a lot longer than 12 if I do. To answer that briefly, I think you have to look at what's happening when. So Cranmer is when he's appointed Archbishop of Canterbury, he is in Nuremberg getting married to the niece of a German Lutheran reformer. At that point, in the mid-1530s, Cranmer is deeply influenced by the kinds of debates that we were looking at. In the early 1530s, the context of what Cranmer is engaging with at that point is Lutheran. By the time we get to the 1540s and we can see that Cranmer's network is starting to extend into Zurich. Not Sir Zwingli, because Zwingli's killed in battle in 1530, so Cranmer never corresponds with Zwingli, as far as we're aware. Into Strasbourg with Martin Bucer, into Zurich with Bullinger. Now, I would not want to say that they're minority or minor. They are key Reformation leaders at this time. Calvin is not yet a Reformation leader at this point. Calvin's just beginning. Calvin's a whole generation younger than the others. He's not born until 1509. So Calvin's influence really starts from the mid-1540s. And one of the things I discovered that I didn't know, that I'm sure I should have known, from reading C.S. Sanson's latest novel, Tombland, if you read the historical comments there, you'll discover that Protector Somerset was in correspondence with Calvin during the period of Edward's minority. So once you get into the Edwardian church, I think we can start to talk about some influence of Cranmer, of Calvin. But Cranmer's correspondence are into Strasbourg and into Zurich. Now, I wouldn't want to say they're minor. They are major figures at this period. They're the people that the Germans are trying to work out whether or not they're going to get them into the Schmalkaldic League. And by the end of the 1540s, Wittenberg is in a war zone, so people are no longer going to be sending theologians to Wittenberg to be trained. So if you can't send them to Wittenberg, where do you send them? You send them to Geneva. And Geneva, in the 1550s and 1560s, becomes the place where theologians start to be trained. But Calvinism is not going to be recognized as a legal religion in the empire until after 1648. So our perceptions of Luther and of Calvin as being the church leaders, you really have to put those into some kind of historical chronological context. And the people that Cranmer is corresponding with and drawing ideas from and bringing to England, so Bucer comes to England, Peter Martyr Vermigli comes to England, because they're fleeing political turmoil and the suppression of Protestantism in the empire. So seeing Cranmer as part of this network, which is itself in moving and shifting and relationships are changing, is I think really important, but I wouldn't want to call them minor.
Sorry, you wanted to ask a question, Kathleen. Hello. A lot of questions on this.
Thank you for all your lecture. I always understood that Henry VIII didn't really bother too much about religion, but what he wanted was to be Pope in his own little backyard, which was not a reformation of faith, but things took off from there. What was the spark that started the Reformation in Scotland, and why? Because Scotland was very different to England, and it was much more insular and Roman Catholic.
Okay, I think there were two massive questions in there. One is, what's Henry VIII actually trying to do? There's a trope in the time, in the period, which you find in Henry VIII is first described as Pope and Emperor in his own country in about 1531, 1532, possibly just before that, but in the late 1520s and 1530s. But what he is picking up is language that's being used elsewhere. So the Duke of Cleves, who later briefly becomes Henry's father-in-law, also finds himself, is describing himself as the Pope and Emperor in his own country. Part of what's going on in this period is rulers who have a strong sense, and their people have a strong sense, that these rulers are given to them by God. What is the ruler's responsibility for religion? And that is the question that I think many rulers define themselves grappling with. It's certainly the question that Henry VIII finds himself grappling with, because he wants to know that God's on his side, and how is he going to know God's on his side? This is, the Tudors have claimed the throne on a very shaky grounds. Henry VIII's father has claimed the throne. How he wants to know that God is on his side is that he's going to be given a son, because that will show him that his dynasty is supposed to be set up. So I think it's very difficult at this period to distinguish political interest and religious interest. Henry VIII himself is a deeply pious young man. He's only 18 when he comes to a throne, so all of this is happening. You know, he's only in his mid-30s when all of this is happening. We know he goes to Mass sometimes, 5 or 6 times a day. He's always got chaplains in his retinue. He clearly enjoys quite, as his daughter Elizabeth also will, quite ceremonial religion. He's a deeply pious person. And I think part of what we're seeing in Henry VIII swinging backwards and forwards is he's being influenced by those who are saying, well, actually, to get God on your side, you need to introduce the Reformation. And those who are saying, well, actually, to have God on your side, you need to stay true to the Catholic traditions. But he would also like to have power over his monastic incomes, and he would like to have more power over his country, and he would like to get divorced. And in the end, it's that he would like to get divorced that actually probably pushes him to move against the papacy. And his own sense that actually Catholic religion is what is sustaining to his own faith, I think. And later on, his pig-headedness. I mean, Henry VIII was no saint. She said, carefully. What happens in Scotland, I think, is much more about, by the time Scotland is really starting to think about the Reformation, they have a choice between a French allegiance that's Catholic and an English allegiance that's Protestant. And what we see battling out in the 1550s and 1560s in Scotland is the same sort of questions that you saw battling out in Geneva in the 1530s. Where are you going to have your allegiance? Is your allegiance going to go to France in Scotland? Then you'll stay Catholic. If your allegiance is going to go to England in Scotland, then you're going to go Protestant. And by the time Elizabeth comes to the throne in England in 1558, the English then have a real incentive not to have a Scottish Catholic country sitting just across the border with a queen who the Catholics say is actually the King Queen of England, because Elizabeth I is, in the eyes of the Catholics, an illegitimate child of her father. Because at the time that she was born, her father's first husband, her first wife, was still alive. So Elizabeth I, in the eyes of Catholics, has no claim to the throne of England because she is an illegitimate daughter. Who has the claim to the throne of England? Mary, Queen of Scots. So actually the English from 1558 onwards have a real incentive for Scotland to become Protestant. And as I'm always saying to my Scottish students, that doesn't mean I think England caused the Reformation in Scotland. There were all sorts of movements already there, but the English spent a lot of money in the late 1550s, trying to get Scotland to move in that direction.
I often hear people saying, why should we be told what to do by unelected bureaucrats from Brussels? We've recently celebrated the end of World War I and the fight for freedom. Isn't there a conflict between this fight for freedom in the wars and being told what to do by Brussels? And has this affected people's thinking, as nobody ever mentions the war in this connection? I noted also that older people, a lot of older people voted Leave compared to the younger people. Mm. Just wondered what you thought. Mm.
Well, I promised not to talk about Brexit, so what do you want me to do?
I think we'll pass over. You've made the point anyway. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think I would want to say, though, I was in Germany last weekend, and I was preaching in my church in Germany last weekend, knowing and having just spent 4 years working on a project on faith in the First World War, knowing that in this country, churches across the nation were marking the centenary of the end of the First World War. And I was preaching in a German church, in a German old Catholic church, and I said to my pastor, to my parish priest, what are we doing about the end of the First World War? And he said, should we be doing anything about the end of the First World War? So I said, well, I don't think personally for myself that I can preach on this weekend without doing anything about it. And then I sat down to write the sermon. And I think this is one of the reasons why we forget. We don't know our own history, but we don't know other people's history either. So I was preaching on the 10th because it was a vigil mass, so it was the night before the Sunday. On the 9th of November 1918, the Emperor of Germany abdicated, which set off, there was a revolution, there had been a revolution. Germany in 1918 was in turmoil. On the 11th of November, armistice is signed. And one of the things I discovered last weekend is, do you know, 11,000 people were killed that morning. I mean, it's just horrific. So that was one of my shocking discoveries last weekend. On the 9th of November 1938, the Reichskristallnacht, the burning of synagogues, the smashing up of Jewish businesses happened intentionally on the anniversary of the abdication of the Kaiser on the 9th of November 1918. So when I walk into church on the 10th of November 2018 in Germany and say, we have a centenary to think about, what on earth am I doing? Because what we are doing, and what are we doing as a country to mark that centenary without talking about the disasters of the 20s that followed? I was giving a paper last week where I was said cheerfully, well, actually, after war, we put in social society. And then somebody picked me up and it said, end of the First World War, Ireland falling apart, Irish Revolution in 1916. And then I thought for myself, and actually out of a conversation I had with somebody here this morning, what was happening in this area in the 1920s and 1930s in terms of super unemployment, hunger marches to London? What era did this centenary that we have been celebrating, what did it actually do? And I think that is the question that I found myself faced with last week. I want to hold on, and I said in my sermon, I want to hold on to the vision of those who came to the end of the war and said, we have to create a better place. We have to create a better Europe. We have to create a better world. I want to hold on to the vision of those who said, what role have the churches played in allowing this to happen? The First World War was seen by many churches as a failure of international Protestantism. And actually, I want to hold on, so we're going to have another set of anniversary, and well, we actually did have this year, 1948, the establishment of the Federal Republic of Germany in 1948. This has been 50 years this year in 1918 since the establishment of Nordrhein-Westfalen, which is where I live in Germany. I want to say that actually part of what has made us peaceful has been actually looking at what war and competition did to society in two world wars. And on that basis, I want to negotiate our future. On the reality of what it is, and if anybody who's lived in Northern Ireland, anybody who has lived in Serbia or has been to Yugoslavia, can tell you what happens when self-interest starts to lead to disaster. And actually, what does that mean? So I'm not saying the answer has to be the EU, but what I am saying is that we have to think of ourselves as a nation, as a people who are connected to others and have a responsibility to make sure these things don't happen again. And the Reformation was a period of terrible disintegration. The period after the First World War was a period, the war itself was a period of terrible disintegration. What happened afterwards was also disintegration. And there's a real sense in which what started in 1914 continued until 1945. And part of what emerged from that period after 1945 was a trying to think of Europe in a new way. We may or may not think it's successful, we may or may not think it's bureaucratic, but that vision of how we think about Europe in a new way, that seems to me, that's what we need to be talking about. Sorry.
Thank you very much. And there are lots of other questions, I know, and you were going to ask one, but apologies, it is actually now exactly 12 o'clock where we said we were, and I can't think of a better note to end on. I think that was very inspirational. Mm-hmm. And Charlotte, thank you again. You've really got so many thoughts going, and we'll be thinking, we want to hear it all again, which of course you can do, because I think it'll be on the website and you'll be able to hear it. On the podcast, so there. But Charlotte, we're really in your debt. Thanks so much for coming and just opening all that to us and making new connections for many of us. Thank you so much.